Okay. Okay. My name is Dan Galadner.
I'm John Elliott, the retired president of the Detroit Federation of Teachers and Teacher.
And teacher.
I was born on June 30th, 1931. I was actually born in Raleigh, West Virginia, which is a coal mining town, and where I spent my early years. My father was, I'm not sure that he was a coal miner, if he wasn't very long, because at the time he died, he was a janitor, a school janitor. But the rest of my male relatives were coal miners. And, well, that was virtually the only job in West Virginia at that time. I guess a few clerks at the company store. And by the way, everything in the community that we lived in and some of the surrounding communities were owned by the coal mines. If you've heard that Johnny Cash, I owe my soul to the company store. Well, it was a truism. It is a truism. I don't know if it's still true or not, but in those days, everything, well, it was kind of like today's credit card. You would go to the company store, you would get what you want, you would sign something, and they'd take it out of your paycheck. Oh, it's on the side of the bed. That doesn't mean they have to talk to me. Okay, back to it. Let's see.
So we're talking about your family as coal miners and the company store.
Yeah, okay. Well, as I said, the company store was a truism. I don't know if it still is or not, because I haven't been down that way in, well, God knows how long. But you could go in, and it didn't matter as long as, well, they knew you. And those small towns in West Virginia, everybody knew everybody. So if you went to the company store, the clerks behind the counter knew you, whether you were a kid or an adult. So basically, all you had to do was tell them what you wanted, and sign, I guess, some kind of paper saying, I bought 2 Tootsie Rolls for 2 cents, mm-hmm. That kind of stuff. So that was that kind of life. The kids went to school because that was the law. And as soon as they were old enough, they would quit and go to the coal mine. My brother and I were born just before World War II. So after my father died, my mother, who had to work, and she did work doing repair work on clothing and a dry cleaners, she came up here because, well, that's what most of the folks down there did during the early years of World War II. They came up here because apparently there were better jobs that paid more than the coal mines. And I assume it was a lot cleaner, too. It was one of those jobs where you took a bath every day.
So your family moved here right before World War II?
Or during, at some point during, I don't really know, mm-hmm. 40, probably somewhere around 42, maybe 43. But.
And where did your mom work?
When she got here, she got another job in a dry cleaning shop. Same thing. In fact, as I got older, I was worked there for a short time, pressing the tops of pants. There was a career for you. And I also had a paper route and worked in supermarkets. They're not anything like they are today. I mean, a lot less product, and it was mainly A&P. There were 2 chains, A&P, and I guess Kroger's was still a fairly active organization then. Of course, now A&P has changed completely. So anyway, I worked at A&P. That's how I got through college, in fact, with my...
Can I go back to... where'd you live in Detroit?
On the east side, initially. That you probably couldn't describe it to you. Let's see, can I get it in relations to the MFT office? No. It's on the east side of Detroit. I guess you'd call it the entry point for black folks who came to Detroit from wherever they came from, mainly the South. But there was essentially a black community in Detroit at that time. And if there was any other black communities in Detroit, I didn't know about them, but most of us who came up here, that's where, well, we lived there, one, because it was a black community. Two, that's where our relatives, because most of us came up.
Is this what it called, Black Bottom?
Black Bottom, that's it. It's just outside of downtown Detroit now. If you need a landmark, there was a it was near the Silver Cup Bread Factory, which is not far. But anyway, we came up. I went to went to Duffield Elementary, and then it was a combined middle and high school then. Miller, I think it was Miller. Middle high school. But we didn't stay that area too long. My mother bought a house out not too far from here, but on Davison near 12th Street, which I'll get into later. That was a notorious area for a while. She bought a house there, and we stayed there for a lot. Well, I stayed there through high school and all that good stuff. And it was probably one of the earliest integrated neighborhoods in Detroit, because it was. But of course, that changed in time. And I graduated from Central High School. When did I graduate? In the 1940s, late 1940s, I think, something, somewhere around there. Anyway, I graduated from high school, got a job, decided I wanted to go to college, and did. And let's see, I started out at the Lawrence, I think it was the Detroit Business School. Was it Lawrence Tech? I think it was the Lawrence Institute of Technology, which in those days was on Woodward Avenue near the railroad tracks, just about a half mile from Davison. And it was a former Ford Motor Company headquarters there for a while. In fact, the big old Ford plant was back behind it. And across the street from a Sears store, both of which are no longer there. Sears moved out to Oakland Mall. Anyway, that's where I started college. Then I did go to Lawrence Tech, but I just wasn't making it at Lawrence Tech. Let's say I was not a natural mathematician. In those days, if you went to Lawrence Tech, you were going to be an engineer. And the emphasis was on math. I mean, you took it all. You got your basic math, if you hadn't done enough in school, or the regular grades. And then you would get into algebra, geometry, analytic geometry, chemistry, you name it. You took it. And it involved lots of math. Well, I had to cut that loose. And then I wound up at Wayne State University, where I decided I was going to be a teacher. And did okay there.
Not bad.
Yeah. Anyway, I graduated from Wayne State. It was nothing like it is now. I don't know if you know Wayne State, but it's got humongous buildings all over the place and air conditioning and all that good stuff. Well, it wasn't like that in my day.
What was it like in the early 60s, late 50s, right?
Late 50s, yeah.
So what was Wayne State like then?
Just a few buildings, some of them used buildings or former office buildings or something like that. It was just a small college. That's all you could say about it. It was growing because it was a state institution, but it was small. And this was another instance where very few blacks went to college, mainly because they had to go to work. But I did. Let's see. I was drafted into the Army early in World War II, and I was overseas for a hot minute, but no, nothing major.
This is Korea.
Korea, right. But I didn't see any action or anything. I often wondered, why the hell is it, you know?
And did you come back? Did you go to school with the GI Bill?
Yes, that was my next point. That yes, I went to school, came back on the GI Bill, which probably got me through. I'm not sure I could have made it. Because when I came back, as I said, I returned to working at A&P. And between A&P and the GI Bill, I got through college, and I don't think I could have made it without that GI Bill, because relatively speaking, college was expensive in those days, or maybe folks like us just didn't earn the kind of income that you had to pay for tuition, but it weren't cheap. At least I don't remember it as being that. So anyway, I graduated from the Wayne State College of Education. And I don't remember the year, but I can find it if it's not there somewhere.
It was 61.
61. Anyway, I graduated, and I started teaching at the school where I had done my student teaching, and that was Hutchins. Was it a junior high school? I think it was Hutchins Junior High School in those days, which is over not far from the current DFT office.
What was teaching like in your first month or so?
It's hard to say. I mean, first of all, I worked in an all-black school, one of the few that the city had at that time, because there weren't that many blacks. I mentioned Miller before, and Hutchins was just turning the point on integration. So I thought, well, hell, you know, I ought to go to an all-black school and teach. And I did, and because they wanted blacks to go to all-black schools. Anyway, I went, and it was tough. Without sounding unkind, the students were mainly little hoodlums. So I ruled my classroom with a paddle, and that was it. And there was not the anti-corporal punishment sentiment that you have today, or at least not in that neighborhood. And so I think I was successful, but at least I had order in my classroom, which is more than some of the teachers could say.
Right. Right.
Especially the new ones, but even some of the experienced ones. The kids were little hellions. So anyway...
Did you have communication with the parents? Did you have communication with the parents?
Oh, yeah. If I had trouble with a kid, I would contact the parents. Most of the parents, I'm sure, didn't have telephones in those days. Too poor. I would contact the parents, and the parents I contacted, it seems to me, in my memory is, if there was a problem with the kid, they would come to the school and find out what it was. And they were definitely not opposed to corporal punishment. They were good. So anyway, I taught at Hutchins for, I think it was 3 or 4 years. The rule at Wayne State where I was the school system rule was, when you were a probationary teacher, you taught for a couple of years and then you were automatically transferred to a school with a different community and background. So they transferred me from Hutchins, which, as I said, had virtually an all-black school and an all-black, or nearly all-black community. And as I said, not too far from the DFT office, which is on Grand Boulevard and the freeway. It was just maybe a mile from there. I transferred to a school out this way, the Hampton middle school, junior high school. They call them junior high schools in those days. At Hampton, it was all white, give or take one or two black kids, and mainly Jewish. At Hampton, on a Jewish holiday, you could count. You could walk out in the halls and count the kids who were there. And they observed the holidays. That's all you can say about it.
I'm sorry, what was the difference in teaching from Hutchins to Hampton?
A world of difference. I mean, say what you want. The Jewish kids, if they didn't want to learn, they had to learn, and they did. And I think they wanted to learn because that was just part of the family tradition. And my guesstimate is that virtually all of them went to college when they graduated from high school. And the local high school that they went to was either Central or Northern. Mainly Northern for that neighborhood. And so, wait a minute, what am I saying? That was Hutchins. Hutchins was Central Northern. And then they transferred me out to Hampton, which is not far from here. It's up near Livernois and 7 Mile. Now that was an all-Jewish school, and that's the one where there was just nobody but us in the hallways on a Jewish holiday. So anyway, I finished my junior high school days at Hampton, and where did I go then? Well, I was supposed to go to Mumford, which is not far from here either. For some reason, I don't think I did. Where the hell did I go?
Cooley?
No. I taught at Cooley, but I didn't. Anyway, maybe it was Central, although I don't think so. Anyway, I graduated from high school. Thought, well, hell, I guess I'll go to college. Tried it. As I said, I started out in some business school in Highland Park. Lewis Business School, whatever. Lawrence Tech? Anyway, I think it was Lawrence Tech. Anyway, I wound up getting drafted into the Army.
So you were drafted?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. This was during the Korean War. Was it Korea? One of those wars. Yeah, anyway, I got drafted into the Army. They sent us down to Fort Knox for basic training. For some reason I still don't remember, other than I guess it was the glamour of it. I decided that I wanted to be a paratrooper. So I went down to Fort Benning, Georgia for airborne training. And from Fort Benning, they sent me to, I was stationed at Fort Benning for a while in an airborne regiment. And I think, was it Eisenhower who was president then? Anyway, a little while after that, I was transferred to the 82nd Airborne Division, which was in North Carolina, South Carolina. Oh, God. Memory's horrible. I think it was North Carolina. It was Fort Bragg. And Fort Bragg, the 82nd Airborne Division, was actually the, I guess, what would you say, the protector or the safety division for Washington, D.C. In other words, if something happened in Washington, D.C., like the race riots, then the 82nd Airborne Division was transferred to someplace outside of Washington to ensure the safety of the federal government and stuff like that. That we were told that was not just a rumor or something somebody made up. So when, if it was, Eisenhower became president, We were the security guard and marched in the presidential parade and all that good stuff. Ah, okay. Well, after I got out of the military, 2 years, I did not re-up. I went, came back to college, Wayne State, I think, and got my degree in teaching. And as I said before, when I got my degree, I asked to be assigned to Hutchins. I was. And again, you only worked there, when you were a probationary teacher, I know I said this earlier, you only worked in your first school a few years. 2 years was the official rule, but because I was a strict teacher and had good classroom control and stuff, and one of a few black teachers at the time, the principal asked that I be left there, and I stood at least another 2 years before I came out to Hampton, which, as I said, was a Jewish school.
Did you join the Detroit Federation of Teachers?
Oh, yeah. It should be in the paper you have there. Mm-hmm. I joined the DFT early on. In fact, I was one of those who was active in the campaign to get union representation for teachers. We didn't have union representation in those days. And we had our opposition was the Michigan Education Association, which was the teacher union. They didn't use the word union. That was a dirty word.
They were still an association.
Yeah, right. Yeah. They were a professional union.
But you knew you wanted to join the DFT. Is this
because? Well, as I said, I was, West Virginia was a union community. And to me, a union was the best. I mean, if you were, lived and worked in West Virginia, and you worked in the coal mines, you belonged to the union. There was no two ways about it. So anyway, I joined the DFT. I was active in the DFT in the early to middle 60s. Doing what, you know, first-timers always do. And in those days, when I first got active, the teachers didn't have union representation. And we worked at it. We still took grievances or handled grievances, and we had, I guess, for that day, a liberal superintendent, or at least he was tolerant. I think that was Brownell. Sam Brownell.
Brownell.
B-R-O-W-N-E-L-L. He was a bastard, but he had his good points, and he would listen to the teachers and stuff like that. He was one of the first... He's one of the few superintendents who ruled the Board of Education. Probably differs from city to city, but in some cases, the Board of Education is the last word on anything. Well, in Detroit, Brownell was the last word. And I think he left here and went someplace, maybe New York, but I don't remember. And we had a string of superintendents. Some mediocre, some less than mediocre. But by that time, the DFT had gotten... Well, first we got a law passed. Was that first? Authorizing collective bargaining for teachers in the state. That was a tough job, largely because, well, even in those days, Michigan was Republican, and you might have collective bargaining for auto workers and retail clerks and stuff, but it was considered a sin for a teacher to be in a union. So, but we finally got it after we got legislation passed authorizing public employee unionization, because it wasn't just teachers that wanted to be unionized, but all public employees wanted a collective bargaining representative.
So you and the DFT, as well as AFSCME and others, go
ahead. Oh, yeah, it's in some of that paper stuff there. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. We had good backing from the UAW, which, it was a strong union in those days, much stronger than it is now. Because, well, auto factories were all around, and they had unionized the auto factories to the nth degree. Oh, with the assistance, and I do mean financial as well as personnel, we finally got public employee unions, which again were authorized by the state. And we started the bargain. We got a contract. I'm not sure whether we were the first union to get a contract or not, because as I said, the MEA was pretty powerful outside of Detroit. So they may have gotten a contract or two in some places ahead of us. But Detroit was the big thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, hell.
Can we go back to the election?
Yeah.
Why don't you explain how that process happened, that you had to have an election to be represented, then you fought off the MEA?
Oh, yeah, sure. Basically, as I said, we had to get legislation creating a union. And part of that legislation, I am virtually sure, was you had to have an election by the teachers or the public employees. Let's just say teachers. There had to be an election to teachers. And again, our primary opposition was the Michigan Education Association. And let's face it, Detroit was a prize. I don't know how many employees Detroit had then, more than 10,000, I'm sure. And we grew some after that, so I may be getting my numbers mixed up. But Detroit was much bigger than it is now, because there was nothing on the other side of 8 Mile Road here, which is the border. In fact, there was nothing here. Really, this house was built in, 42, something like that. And Mumford High School, which is just a little ways up, was just starting to fill up with the Jewish students who were moving out of the core or central city. So anyway, we were elected over the MEA for as collective bargaining representative.
Then you had to sit down and hammer out a contract. Was it a basic contract? Was it a simple or?
A very simple. The first one, I'm sure, was a very simple one. I don't know if I have a copy of it in there or not. But it was a very simple contract, as you would expect. You know, we had the right to represent the members with grievances. In fact, the members had the right to file a grievance, which they didn't have before. And you could take a principal to, those days, the school board, and eventually to arbitration, which was, I think, a real prize in those days, because, hell, the school board was more than likely going to support the principal anyway. Some of them were fair. I mean, I don't want to say they're all unfair. But the principal had an edge going in. But we did eventually get the Michigan Employment Relations Commission to hear. We had a right to appeal to the Michigan Employment Relations Commission on grievances and on contract settlement if the two parties just weren't getting together. And so I would say we took good advantage of it. In those days, I don't think we do that now. We always had a lawyer when we went to Merck, Michigan Employment Relations Commission, who would, I guess you'd call it a semi-court hearing or whatever, but we had a lawyer, which was Theodore Sachs, Ted Sachs, who unfortunately is no longer there, although the union still uses his law firm. And, Ted was just, he was a gem, that's all I can say. He didn't only represent the DFT, but he represented other unions as well. And, between Ted, our expertise as we gained it, we got to be pretty good. Obviously, one of the leading teacher unions in the state. We struck about three times, I think, during the 60s.
Okay, when we talk about the first strike, 1967, I believe it was.
Sounds about right.
And do you remember what the issues were?
The usual pay, bargaining rights, grievance settlement. I mean, you know,
Dad?
Yeah.
This is me.
Okay, this is my son. Just the beginning, okay. Basic stuff. As I suspect, almost every union that's just getting off the ground, even probably the UAW. We just, let's say we had to establish ourselves, and always looking over our shoulder was the Michigan Education Association.
Were they still challenging
the
with elections?
Yeah. I mean, let's see, they challenged us, well, 67, something like that. Then they came back, and I think it was the second time, the challenge was headed by a former DFT member who had run against me, Tom Cook. I don't know how or what, but Tom somehow or other got involved with the MEA, and they filed again for a collective, I mean, for an election, a bargaining unit, and Tom headed it, but as I recall, we beat them rather handily, as I recall.
Yeah.
And then they came back one other time, lost badly, and then we got word that they were not ever going to come back. Because, well, three times, strike out.
Yeah.
So we went on from there. We also helped the other employees. I was president by then. Get collective bargaining. Because, obviously, for a while there, the teachers were the only ones with bargaining. But if you talk to Ruby Newbold, I'm not sure when he was active then. We helped the clerical workers, and the custodians probably did it on their own because they were part of the AFL-CIO. And the operating engineers, well, they were a kingdom all of themselves. I mean, when you got the switch that turns on the heat and stuff like that, you have a lot to say. Anyway, the engineers. So in a short time, all of the unions had collective bargaining rights. I would just estimate by 1970, even...
Were the paras organized?
About that time, yeah. I don't remember when federal aid really took off as a major factor in school funding, but the paras were created as a result of your folks.
That's Greg. Yeah. You ready to go again?
As okay. I said, the paras were created because of the creation of federal funding for education. Who was that?
Johnson.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, they were created for that. Otherwise, I think most of the other unions were around at that time.
And what was Detroit like? Was it started to integrate, or
well,
school
it
system?
Was disintegrating, really. I mean, it was integrated for a very short period of time, but it was neighborhoods. Well, for example, when I moved out here in the 40s, I would guess anywhere from 70 to 90% of this block was white. Well, that didn't last too long. They started to jump on the other side of 8 Mile Road, which just was created, the old park, which is directly on the other side, and Royal Oak and Southfield. In fact, about that time, I think, Hudson's started to, mostly that was when I was in college, yeah. Anyway, it started to disintegrate, and it took a while, obviously. But part of it was the... Hi, this is my son, Gary. Anyway, part of it was because the J.L. Hudson Company, which I think is Macy's now, built the Northland Shopping Center over on James Cousins and 8 Mile, which is a couple of miles from here at minimum. And I think that started the exodus out of the city, or Hudson's was able to predict that it was going to happen because they built it on right now on the corner of 8 Mile and James Cousins, which is a freeway out of the city. If you're going to Lansing or someplace, you take the Lodge Freeway, US 10. Anywho, this area started to grow, as did others. I mean, Dearborn was around in those days, and other sub, well, they weren't. The, well, it, actually, anything on the other side of 8 Mile or Telegraph, Green Lawn, whatever it was, the western edge of the city was just, hey, there was nothing there but forest, trees, weeds. So, anyhow, I went to Lawrence Tech. Lawrence Tech, I think I said earlier, moved from Highland Park out to 10 Mile and what is now James Cousins. It was all forest out there then. What made them move out there, I don't know, other than maybe they predicted that was where people were going.
And the schools were being affected by this?
What?
The schools being affected by everybody leaving?
Well, eventually, yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, in communities like Oak Park, first of all, they had to build schools, and they had to make sure that they had a population that would support the schools. But in time, the suburbs just grew. And as the suburbs grew, Detroit started to shrink. And I think I saw something in the papers yesterday, day before yesterday, something like that. Detroit is losing something like 60,000 people a year. And so we're still losing population. But anyway, they all moved out, and you know, as I said, you had your Ferndale and your Oak Park and your Southfield and whatever is west of Southfield, and then it just spread on out until now. You can drive out US 10, the extension of the Lodge, to Brighton, which is 30 some miles outside of the city, and don't see anything but buildings and homes and stuff like that. Whereas in my day, when I first started going to Lansing, I was a DFT lobbyist for a while. When I first started going to Lansing, hell, you hit the other side of 10 Mile and there weren't nothing but woods, trees, and forests. And in fact, before you got to 10 miles, there was a lot of that. But, as I said, Northland was probably the creator of some of this, what do you call it, northern movement. And, anyway, it's grown since then, and as I said, the integration just is no longer here.
Could this be possibly why the population of Detroit wanted to decentralize the school system?
I think that was just one of those phases. That might have been the given reason. I don't remember. I think that was just one of those phases that school systems go through sometime. You know, we have a central board with people from all... Anybody who wanted to run could run, and it didn't matter where you're from. And then we went through that period where We had districts. It was a central system, but the system was divided into districts with their own superintendent. That didn't accomplish anything. It was too damn expensive because each one of those districts wanted their own administrative staff. You didn't do a damn thing.
How did that affect the union?
Only in that we had to handle grievances or district problems with the district superintendent, and then if that didn't work, we'd go to the central superintendent. It probably took a little more staff, but it was just one of those, you know, administrative things, to be kind, that didn't accomplish much, largely because the district superintendent, he didn't give a damn or thought he ruled the world, and the world being his district. But we usually got, you know, fair treatment from the central administration in those days, because there was some controversy between the districts and the central.
And this brought about this decentralization of Detroit, didn't that spawn the Milliken Bradley case about busing in Detroit? Do you remember that?
Not specifically. Yeah, there was busing. The busing, as I recall, was usually had something to do with the ability of the district to handle the kids they had. In short, in the central city, people were moving out, families were moving out here. And some of the schools just didn't have the enough kids to handle certain grade levels, or, as was probably as much the case as anything else, we were going through this bit about integration. And in the central city, it was mainly black. Whereas out here, Mumford High School up here, McDowell Elementary up here, it's all white. So that was part of the busing thing. You couldn't have a city that was, let's see, had a sizable black population all going to school together, and the whites on the edges all going to school together. So that was a part of the reason for busing. So I would imagine between the two, that is, not enough kids for the elementary schools in the central city. Well, they even combined them, though. I mean, schools like, Duffield and Miller went from elementary schools, K-6 or K-3 or 3 through 6, to elementary middle, K through 8 or 9, for that reason. But that was expensive, again, because you might not have enough kids, and so then you had to have combined classes, and that don't work worth a damn. You know, you got a bunch of 8th graders and 9th graders in the same classroom. No, thank you. I was there for that one. Well, you know, you got to have two different curriculums, or somebody's going to suffer, and usually the kids just didn't. Let's say the 9th graders got 8th grade math, or vice versa. So, yeah, we went through all of those little phases, and a lot of them were just the style, the school style of the time. Well, I know Hampton, which is just up the street here again, Livernois 7 Mile, was one of those that had it for a while, and it just didn't work. It wasn't a problem in the central city because there weren't. The whites got out of there in a hurry. But when they got out here, they got established. I was probably the second black on this block when I moved out here in the 40s. And the people in Clark's across the street were the first. And, of course, that changed in time. But, integration was one of the fashionable things of its day.
And how was the union handling?
Oh, as far as I can remember, we were for it. I have to think. Mary Ellen Reardon was our president. When did Mary Ellen leave office?
She left in 80.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, because I was trying to get it together. I'm thinking 60s, and I knew that was wrong. I got involved in the union in the 60s. Not too long after I joined the system, and again, it was because the union was a way of life to me. So anyway, I got involved and got on the executive board. Got on the executive board. Got on the staff eventually.
What year was this, Chad?
old, late 60s. I think I've got it on paper somewhere here. Anyway, it was during the 60s, and let's see, I became president in what, 88 or something?
81.
81?
President?
Mm-hmm. Ooh, boy, okay. Anyway, let's see, I ran against Mary Ellen, I think I won. Then a guy named Tom Cook, who was a Mary Ellen supporter, ran against me. He lost, and if I said it before, forgive me, but when he lost the second time or so, somehow or other he fell in with the MEA and came back and failed again.
Why don't we just go back to, you became a part of the executive board. Were you part of the Reardon team?
Oh, yeah. I was part of the Reardon team from day one. I was part of the Reardon team for day one. Mm-hmm. Until, of course, I ran against
you. Yeah, until you ran against. Also, didn't you return back to the classroom?
Yeah, when I lost the election, I wasn't going back to the union office.
Right.
So I had to go back to the classroom. And that basically, I think when I ran and lost, I went to Cooley High School.
Can you describe, you said you were teaching in the beginning, early 60s, mm-hmm. and you returned back into teaching in 75. Mm-hmm. What were the big differences did you see?
I don't know, and I tell you, you remember now, I started out in mainly black schools. Cooley was still integrated, and a pretty damn good school in that day. So it's kind of hard to say, only because, like going from Hutchins to Hampton, it's just two different worlds. And so therefore, it's hard to say that what it was like, other than Hampton obviously had kids who wanted to learn, who were expected to go to college and did, and so forth, whereas with Hutchins, it was the family from day one was just involved in economic survival. You were lucky if you had a factory job, which was, you know, guaranteed work. Anyway, I don't think you can compare schools in a city like this at any point in time. It depends on the economics of the community. And I don't think you could be... let's just say it was so different that it was just like having different suburban schools by income.
Okay.
It's even like that today. This area is obviously a different income from down in the central city and probably the wealthiest communities over on the east side near the Grosse Pointe, and probably the best achieving schools in the city are in that area.
So you run against Mary Ellen in 1980 with under the UTR, was that the United Teachers Rights?
Right, yeah, that was sweet. Those of us who were breaking with the Reardon team.
Why was there a break with the Reardon team?
Well, I would say offhand now, you know, with the hindsight, that, you know, just another group that thought that we can do things better. I'm not sure why I even ran myself, other than, hey, I can be president. And as I said, the city was changing. The racial makeup of the teachers was changing. Mary Ellen was either retired or going to retire, and everybody knew it. So it was just one of those political things. Just like when Tom Cook left, and I'm not sure why the hell he did leave and ran against her. If he had stayed, he'd have been he might have been president. Should have been.
So what was it like becoming president of DFT? What was your major changes you wanted in place in the union?
I didn't make many changes, to tell you the truth. Staff-wise, I knew the staff, I knew their capabilities, and so forth and so on. So I kept the staff. That surprised the hell out of a lot of people. I mean, obviously I was president. I put one of my running mates, Carol Thomas, in as executive vice president. And maybe one other person in as administrative assistant. But I knew most of those folks anyway, and they knew me. So it wasn't any hostility or antagonism. And hey, a job in the union office is better than teaching school. So I kept most of the staff, to the surprise of some, I'm sure. But we kind of floated along. I knew most of the top administrators in the school center's building because of my days on the Reardon team and negotiating contracts and handling grievances. So my memory is that it was a fairly simple changeover or change in leadership.
Good. But then you stepped into the 1980s, though, Reagan economics, teacher hiring, freezes on teachers and salaries. So there was a strike in 1982.
I don't remember. We had a lot of them.
Yeah, did you remember Arthur Jefferson as superintendent?
Oh, yeah, Arthur Jefferson. He was a bastard in his own way, but you could talk to him. He would listen. I mean, I used to have, one-on-one conferences with Art, and, it may not have been obvious, but usually we got along, and if we could agree on something and agree what we'd say and what our people would do, we could come to an agreement. Okay. Arthur Jefferson was probably as good a superintendent as we had. The worst was David Sneed, who was the principal. If you've ever worked with principals, there are some principals who can work with people and get along fine, and others who issue orders and expect them and expect you to, when he bent over, to do kiss his ass. Well, that was
okay. Let's get back. We were just talking about early 80s Detroit. What was the climate in Detroit during the early to mid 80s?
Well, once again, it depends on where you live. I think there was a touch of hostility and anxiety in some neighborhoods because of the race thing. And, of course, the auto industry was starting to shift out of Detroit and Michigan, and that created a job problem. And that always creates hostility among people. But let's see. And, the staff in the schools started to change because, the white teachers could and would get jobs elsewhere. In fact, up until probably just recently, Ann Arbor would publicly declare they would recruit. Their best recruiting was done here in Detroit. Ann Arbor is the University of Michigan, if you want to put it that way, but they could get access to experienced teachers, and I guess they could pick and choose who they want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just read that New York City was even coming here to recruit teachers.
I have heard that. I don't know that for a fact, but I know school districts like Ann Arbor, Southfield, Ferndale would recruit experienced teachers. They didn't have to hire new teachers. They could get experienced teachers here in Detroit.
So how was that affecting the union membership?
Well, it didn't affect the union, as I think I said earlier. because if you were an employee, you had to join the union. Mm-hmm. We negotiated that probably back in the 60s.
Agency fee 70, 1970.
Okay.
Yep.
And either that or pay what an agency shop fee, which was just a few dollars less than the dues, and people soon learned or felt that the union was on their side, so you know they signed up for the union. And I kind of suspect the building reps, who were overall pretty loyal union members, convinced them that it was better to be a union member than an agency shopper.
But yeah. How did the union try to retain qualified good teachers from leaving?
Well, they really weren't active in that because, well, I don't know, we just didn't, other than if we could talk somebody into it, we would. We certainly wouldn't be encouraging people to leave because, hey, face it, the people who leave are the best ones or the good ones, and you're left with the son of a bitches who are always in trouble. And you don't need that. I mean, unions don't need troubled people. So we certainly didn't discourage, I mean, encourage people to leave, but if we could work with the school system to come up with something that would keep people in Detroit, we would do it.
Did you try to start a peer review plan like Toledo did in the early 80s?
No, I don't think we did.
Okay.
If we did, it was minor in nature. That was more or less the responsibility of the school system. I don't recall that we did.
Okay. I was just curious, that's all.
Oh, yeah. I don't know why we didn't, but I certainly think it's a good idea.
Uh-huh. Remember when the Nation at Risk plan came out? The Nation at Risk report came out. Remember when that came out, Nick? 83?
I remember the title.
Yeah.
And I think I seem to recall that it had something to do with big city schools and the way that kids in big city schools, particularly what we call the inner city, were falling behind.
What I remember is Albert Shanker said that he agreed with the report, where everybody else was against it. And he said because they're not criticizing, they're saying this is how we're going to help schools.
Mm-hmm.
And some people think that was the shift of AFT from a bread and butter union to a professional union. That is,
okay,
education reform thing. Did you see any education reform actions here in Detroit that helped teachers, or was this other phases and trends?
I don't think there was an education reform that actually helped teachers. Again, I think teaching, except for the curriculum you had to offer the kids. I mean, you had to teach the kids. I'm convinced it was more the personality and style of the teacher that helped teachers. If you had a good, strong principal who backed up his teachers, that helped a lot. We had both. But I don't think... Rarely did anything ever come from the school board or from the central administration that was helpful to teachers.
How about helpful for the kids for learning?
Same thing. Being union the way I am, I don't have a high opinion of central administration. Even if you had a good superintendent, the people who were under him they were earning a buck. And that was about it. If I had to make a choice, the principal or his or her management style would be the best assistance for teachers. And best central administration could do would be get books and supplies to the schools if they had the money and the desire.
So, remember when the HOPE campaign came into the school board?
Mm-hmm.
Did they have any agenda or plan that you thought was worthwhile keeping?
Well, I think that group was about as phony a group as you can get. No, they didn't, to be specific. I mean, they would say things that were popular and made sense. They just didn't do it. We got to involve the community. We've got to have community councils and all that stuff. Well, hell, we had those before. They're called something else, I guess. But like all communities, it depends on the desire of the parents